This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Today we celebrate Black History Month with two labor speeches by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., which demonstrate King's involvement with unions and his perception of their centrality to the struggle for civil and human rights and against poverty and war. While times have changed, the messages of these speeches are unfortunately still relevant today. We present speeches by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. to labor organizations. The first is to the Chicago Labor Peace Assembly on November 11, 1967, introduced by Cleveland Robinson, Secretary Treasurer of District 65. And the second, a freedom salute, is to Local 1199 on March 10, 1968. It is introduced by Local 1199 President Leon Davis.
Like Dr. King, 65ers have always been unalterably opposed to the war in Vietnam. On November 11th, 1967, leaders of 65, along with hundreds of other trade union leaders, at a Chicago Labor Conference for Peace, heard from Dr. King on the war in Vietnam.
Mr. Chairman and distinguished dais guests, my brothers and sisters of the labor movement, ladies and gentlemen, I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here this afternoon and to be some little part of this extremely significant assembly. For it is my deep conviction that it will have tremendous meaning and impact in the days to come. I don't feel that I come among strangers today, for I feel that I'm an honorary member of many labor unions all across the country. I'm delighted to be here, and I want to get right into the message, and I want to try to talk very honestly and frankly about this great problem, this great issue that we face as a result of the war in Vietnam. Some of my words may appear to be rather harsh, but they will be as harsh as truth and as gentle as a nonviolent devotee would be. And I want to use as a subject the domestic impact of the war in America. And this question is historic because it is an authentic expression of the conscience of the labor movement. As has been said already this afternoon, tens of millions of Americans oppose a war in Vietnam. Never in our history has there been such a passionate popular resistance to a current war. In addition to the millions upon millions of ordinary people, eminent scholars, distinguished senators, journalists, businessmen, professionals, students, and political leaders at all levels have protested the war and offered alternatives with an amazing tenacity and boldness. But one voice was missing, the loud, clear voice of labor. The absence of that one voice was all the more tragic because it may be the decisive one for tipping the balance toward peace. Labor has been missing. For too long, the moral appeal has been flickering, not shining as it did in its dynamic days of growth. This conference, a united expression of varied branches of labor, reaffirms that the trade union movement is part of forward-looking America. Yeah. that no matter what the formal resolutions of higher bodies may be, the troubled conscience of the working people cannot be stilled. This conference speaks for millions. And you here today will long be remembered as those who had the courage to speak out and the wisdom to be right. It is noteworthy that the Labour Party of Great Britain, which of course has no responsibility for our actions, nonetheless went on record on October 4th in a formal national resolution calling upon its Labour government to dissociate itself completely from U.S. policy in Vietnam. It urged its government to persuade the United States to end the bombing of North Vietnam immediately, permanently, and unconditionally. Now, what are some of the domestic consequences of the war in Vietnam? It has made the Great Society a myth and replaced it with the troubled and confused society. The war has strengthened domestic reaction. It has given the extreme right, the anti-labor, anti-Negro, and anti-humanistic forces a weapon of spurious patriotism to galvanize its supporters into reaching for power right up to the White House. It hopes to use national frustration to take control and restore the America of social insecurity and power for the privileged. When a Hollywood performer, lacking distinction even as an actor, can become a leading war hawk candidate for the presidency, only the irrationalities induced by a war psychosis can explain such a melancholy turn of events. The war in Vietnam has produced a shameful order of priorities in which the decay, squalor, and pollution of the cities are neglected. And even though 70% of our population now live in them, the war has smothered and nearly extinguished the beginnings of progress toward racial justice. The war has created the bizarre spectacle of armed forces of the United States fighting in ghetto streets in America while they are fighting in jungles in Asia. The war has so increased Negro frustration and despair that urban outbreaks are now an ugly feature of the American scene. How can the administration, with quivering anger, denounce the violence of ghetto Negroes when it has given an example of violence in Asia that shocks the world? The users of naval guns, millions of tons of bombs, and revolting napalm cannot speak to Negroes about violence. Only those who are fighting for peace have the moral authority to lecture on nonviolence. Now, I do not want to be misunderstood. I am not equating the so-called Negro violence with the war. The acts of Negroes are infinitely less dangerous and immoral than the deliberate acts of escalation of the war in Vietnam. In fact, the Negroes in the ghetto, goaded and angered by discrimination and neglect, have for the most part deliberately avoided harming persons. They have destroyed property, but even in the grip of rage, the vast majority have vented their anger on inanimate things, not people. When I first decided to take a firm stand against the war in Vietnam, I was subjected to the most bitter criticism by the press, by individuals, and even by some fellow civil rights leaders. There were those who said that I should stay in my place, that I was a civil rights leader, and that these two issues did not mix, and I should stick with civil rights. Well, I had only one answer for that, and it was simply the fact that I have struggled too long and too hard now to get rid of segregation in public accommodations to end up at this point in my life segregating my moral concern. And I made it very clear that I recognize that justice was indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And then there were those who said, you heard in the civil rights movement, and one spoke to me one day and said, now, Dr. King, don't you think you're going to have to agree more with the administration's policy? I understand that your position on Vietnam has hurt the budget of your organization, and many people who respected you in civil rights have lost that respect, and don't you think that you are going to have to agree more with administration's policy to regain this? And I had to answer by looking that person into the eye and say, I'm sorry, sir, but you don't know me. I'm not a consensus leader. I do not determine what is right and wrong by looking at the budget of my organization or by taking a Gallup poll of the majority opinion. Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a sucher for consensus, but a molder of consensus. On some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must take it because conscience tells him it is right.
And now, I have the great pleasure and honor to introduce a great American, a great leader of a great people. He is one of us. He walked our picket lines. He came to us and encouraged us. He inspired us. He led us. He is our own Martin Luther King, who comes to us again with a message of peace, a message of freedom, a message of encouragement.
I want to express my deep personal appreciation and the appreciation of all of the officers and members of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference for the great support that you in 1199 have given us in the past, and for this contribution of $4,000 that you have given us tonight. I don't consider myself a stranger. I've been with 1199 so many times in the past that I consider myself a fellow 1199er. There are times that I'm often disenchanted with some segments of the power structure of the labor movement. But in those moments of disenchantment, I began to think of unions like Local 1199, and it gives me renewed courage and vigor to carry on, and the feeling that there are some unions left that will always maintain the radiant and vibrant idealism that brought the labor movement into being. I would suggest that if all of labor would emulate what you have been doing over the years, our nation would be closer to victory in the fight to eliminate poverty and injustice. I also believe that if all of labor were to follow your example of mobilizing and involving working people in the campaign to end the war in Vietnam, our nation would be much closer to a swift settlement of that immoral, unjust, and ill-considered war. It's about our Poor People's Campaign, our campaign for jobs or income, which will begin a few weeks from now. And I want to deal with all of this by using as a subject from which to speak the other America. And I use this subject because there are literally two Americas. In a sense, one America is beautiful for situation. That America is flowing with the milk of prosperity and the honey of equality. That America is made up of millions of young people who grow up in the sunlight of opportunity. I'm sure that each of us is painfully aware of the fact that that is another America. And that other America has a daily ugliness about it that transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In that other America, millions of people find themselves forced to live in inadequate, substandard, and often dilapidated housing conditions. And in these conditions, they don't have wall-to-wall carpet, but all too often they find themselves living with wall-to-wall rats and roaches. In this other America, thousands, even millions of young people are forced to attend inadequate, substandard, inferior, qualityless schools, and year after year, thousands of young people in this other America finish our high schools reading at an eighth and a ninth grade level sometimes, not because they are dumb, not because they don't have innate intelligence, but because the schools are so inadequate, so overcrowded, so devoid of quality, so segregated, if you will, that the best in these minds can never come out. And then probably the most critical problem in the other America is the economic problem. By the millions, people in the other America find themselves perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. The fact is that the black man in the United States of America is facing a literal depression. Now, you know they don't call it that. When there is massive unemployment in the black community, it's called a social problem. When there's massive unemployment in the white community, it's called a depression. The problem is not only unemployment, it's under a sub-employment. People who work full-time jobs for part-time wages. Most of the poor people in our country are working every day. They are making wages so inadequate that they cannot even begin to function in the mainstream of the economic life of the nation. You know where they are working. So often they are working in our hospitals and all over this country. I thank God for what your union has done and what you continue to do. I can remember just a few years ago, right here in this city, that hospital workers made wages so inadequately that it was a shame to say to anybody that these people were being paid. But I've been over the country, and I know about it. I've been on the picket lines. Hospital workers, whether it's at St. Luke's in Cleveland or somewhere else in Chicago. And I think of the fact that in most instances, and all too many instances, hospital workers are not yet organized. And just think of the low wages in Atlanta, Georgia. I move around as a minister, having to visit in the hospital's members, and I move around and meet people over and over again. And think of the fact that they're working every day, working hard, and yet making enough money to even have adequate food to eat somewhere in life. People of justice and goodwill come to see the dignity of labor. And somewhere they come to see that if that person working in the hospital, even if you happen to be a janitor in the hospital, is in the final analysis as significant as the physician, because if he doesn't do his job, germs can develop, which can be as injurious to the patient as anybody else. We look around and we see thousands and millions of people making inadequate wages every day. Not only do they work in our hospitals, they work in our hotels, they work in our laundries, they work in domestic service. They find themselves underemployed. You see, no labor is really menial unless you're not getting adequate wages. People are always talking about menial labor. Well, if you're getting a good, you know, $4.50 or something an hour, as I know that through some unions they've brought it on up to the point of getting employees in certain areas to that point, that isn't menial labor. What makes it menial is the income, the wages. Now, what we've got to do is to attack the problem of poverty and really mobilize the forces of our country to have an all-out war against poverty, because what we have now is not even a good skirmish against poverty. Now, every year about this time, our newspapers and televisions and people generally began to talk about the long, hot summer ahead. And what always bothers me about this is that the long, hot summer has always been preceded by a long, cold winter. And the tragedy is that the nation has failed to use its winters creatively, compassionately, concerned enough. And our nation's summers of riots are still caused by our nation's winters of delay. Now, I know that something has to be done, but I'm still absolutely convinced that nonviolence, massively organized, powerfully executed, militantly developed, is still the most potent weapon available to the black man in his struggle. The fact is that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. Man was on a plane with me the other day, and I just didn't feel like arguing. He said, now, the thing is, you all need to do something for yourself. And then he started telling me about his ethnic background and his parents coming from a country in Europe and how they had lifted themselves by their own bootstraps. And then he said, why don't you Negroes do that? He couldn't pronounce the word Negro. He meant well, really. Now, I had to look at him, and I didn't mean any harm. As I said, I wasn't in an arguing mood. But I looked at him, and I said, "Sir, do you recognize that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil?" And then I went on to say to him, "But, sir, I got another thing I want to mention to you, that the nation made my color a stigma." Open Roget's Thesaurus. That's a book that gives you all of the synonyms of words. And if you look there for the synonyms for black, they all represent some evil, integrating, smut, dirty, you know, everything you want. Synonyms of white: pure, chaste. What I'm simply saying is that we are going to demand what is ours. And my friends, the resources are here in America. The question is whether the will is here. There's something wrong with the policies, the priorities, and the purposes of our nation now. And we've got to say it in no uncertain terms. And I simply say to you that I'm afraid that our government is more concerned about winning an unjust war in Vietnam than about winning the war against poverty right here at home. And I say, if we will stand and work together, we will bring into being that day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. We will bring into being that day when America will no longer be two nations, but it will be one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
This has been Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.